Let's get down to business. Taking a look at Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 288 at 17,356. S&P 500 up 40 at 2,012. NASDAQ Composite up 96 at 4,644. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note up 8 basis points at 2.15%. Oil up 6 cents at $55.94 per barrel. Gold down $6.10 at $1,189.90 per ounce. Silver up 3 cents at $15.85. I've been telling you for a few years now that the Fed is a vital force in the stock market. I've talked about how the stock market has advanced right along with the Fed's balance sheet. Today absolutely confirms what I've been telling you. Most major indices started the day a little higher, then jumped following the Fed's FOMC statement, and again during Chairwoman Janet Yellen's press conference. At one point, the Dow Industrial Average was up about 300 points, and then people started to digest what was being said, which is what we will do right now. The Federal Reserve indicated it was moving closer to raising interest rates from record low levels because the economy and job market are getting stronger. The Fed also promised to take a patient approach in doing so, which sounded very reassuring to investors. It sounded like the Fed wouldn't tighten credit too soon and endanger the economic recovery. They won't surprise us or rush to tighten next year. The Fed kept the phrase considerable time, and then they added that they will be patient, which really did not help to provide clarity or precision. Yellen's press conference covered a range of topics. She said a short period of very low unemployment will help get inflation back to target. And we may be closer to the inflation target than we think because market-based expectations for inflation can't be entirely trusted to give clear signals. The drop in the market's expectations for inflation could also reflect other factors such as the flight to safety and treasuries. The Fed puts more weight on survey-based measures derived from consumer expectations and economists' forecast. This morning, before the Fed statement, we had a report on inflation. The Consumer Price Index, the CPI, prices at the retail level, fell by a seasonally adjusted 0.3% last month to mark the largest drop since December 2008. Energy cost fell for a fifth straight month, led by a 6.6% decline in the price of gasoline. The cost of food rose just 0.2% in November. And for people who don't drive or eat, they strip out volatile food and energy costs, so-called core inflation, up just 0.1% last month. The pace of inflation over the past 12 months fell to 1.3% in November, down sharply from 2.1% just 5 months ago. Real hourly wages are up just 0.8% over the past 12 months, so there really is no inflationary pressure from wages. But the Fed doesn't seem concerned about lowflation. The plunge in oil prices is a plus for the economy and will have only a transitory impact on inflation. Their thinking is that they are on track for their inflation target of 2%, more or less, give or take, maybe. Except it isn't happening now. In fact, 2014 will mark the first time in at least 55 years not one advanced economy will see consumer prices growing more than 4% this year. But the Fed isn't particularly worried about weakness in the global economy or low oil prices or the meltdown in Russia. They are aware and monitoring, they say, but not very concerned. The Fed will raise rates at some point. Probably. Keep in mind that Ben Bernanke talked about raising rates, but he never quite got around to it. But Yellen's Fed will be raising rates, but they will be patient. The first rate hike won't come for at least a couple of meetings, Yellen said. And then she said a couple means two. So that sounds like a rate hike in March, but Yellen says more likely before the summertime, but that's not a promise or commitment, more like a qualified maybe. Raising rates too quickly could increase low-flationary pressures, and it could doom millions of workers to subpar incomes, unemployment, or underemployment. Raising rates too slowly could theoretically increase inflationary pressures, but the real danger in the mind of the Fed is that low rates encourage risky financial behavior, the kind of risky behavior that led to the last couple of boom and bust cycles. It's not just the departure date that matters, Yellen says. The pace of subsequent rate hikes is what is important, and that will depend on the data. And after all the tap dancing was over, we were back to where we started, which is the idea that the Fed will raise rates probably sometime around June, as long as the economy continues to improve pretty much as expected and nothing collapses unexpectedly, more or less. Now, since the press conference, I've been reading about Yellen's performance, and it is easy to proclaim the Fed is wishy-washy or uncertain or guessing. But if you've been following the Fed for a long time, and I have, this is just standard operating procedure. When Yellen says a rate hike could happen in a couple of meetings, it's a trial balloon. When they add language about being patient, they are testing the markets while trying to be reassuring. One thing the Fed has learned is not to make sudden movements. It did not work well in 2008. It did not work well in 1987. And it does not look like there will be any sudden movements in the foreseeable future. Maybe. Treasuries declined after the Fed statement. The stock market moved higher. Enjoy. Have a cigar. Not some beat-up old stogie, but a real cigar. A Cuban. Well, actually, you can't do that today, but maybe soon. President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro announced today they would begin normalizing relations between the two nations as part of a deal brokered by Pope Francis. The Pope played a key role in the talks, sending a letter to Castro and Obama urging them to resolve the dispute over Alan Gross and pursue closer relations. The request from the Pope was rare and came shortly after a meeting Obama had with Pope Francis at the Vatican earlier this year. The action means not simply the opening of a U.S. embassy in Havana, but the lifting of some of the restrictions that have limited travel and commerce and kept aficionados from legally bringing Cuban cigars to U.S. soil. The announcement was wrapped into the release of American aid worker Alan Gross and the exchange of a U.S. spy for three Cuban intelligence agents. Obama and Castro made simultaneous announcements in Washington and Havana to outline the rapprochement. The U.S. will issue regulations within weeks and will open an embassy as soon as logistically possible. Obama said he would engage Congress in an honest and serious debate about changing legislation to fully end the U.S. embargo of Cuba. Some legislators have already vowed to block any change in legislation. If it goes through, though, U.S. companies will be permitted to export to Cuba telecommunications equipment, agricultural commodities, construction supplies, and materials for small businesses. U.S. financial institutions will be allowed to open accounts with Cuban banks. Exports will mainly be permitted to Cuba's emerging private sector, including residential goods and equipment for small businesses and agriculture. And there will be some travel permitted for U.S. citizens, but not tourism, not now. Limits on Cuban-American remittances to relatives in their homeland will jump to $8,000 from $2,000 annually. Why, after more than 50 years, did a breakthrough in Cuban-American relations happen now? Well, there are many reasons, but one factor is oil. Cuba has been getting about 100,000 barrels of oil per day from Venezuela in exchange for medical personnel. The collapse in oil prices now leaves Venezuela's economy in terrible shape. With the world's fastest inflation and the country's bonds on the verge of default, the country faces a 60% chance of defaulting on its foreign debt in the second half of next year if oil prices do not recover. Cuba recognized that it was very risky to be overly dependent on Venezuela. Cuba, well aware of the risk of dependency after the economy collapsed in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed. Cuba and Venezuela are not the only countries facing problems with low oil prices. Russia, of course, we talked about that yesterday. Tomorrow, Putin will talk about it. The Russian president will face questions from the media at his annual press conference. Whether a few words from Putin will restore the status of Russian stocks and the ruble remains to be seen. On December 8th, Moody's gave six Middle Eastern countries a thumbs up based on the assumption that oil prices will average $80 to $85 a barrel next year. That assumption now seems suspect. Yesterday, oil prices briefly dipped down around $53 a barrel. Today, crude for January delivery down as low as $54.21. While Gulf states can make some spending cuts, they'll need to do more to cover likely shortfalls. The states with bigger sovereign wealth funds will tap them as needed. The ones with weaker positions will borrow. Many of these oil-producing countries run sovereign wealth funds, which are largely funded by oil. They are pretty certain not to be making new investments and are likely to be making some sales. Not only will their sales have some impact at the margin, but their absence as deep-pocket opportunist could be more important than one might imagine. Recall that in the early stages of the financial crisis, sovereign wealth funds stepped up to provide capital to quite a few of the wobbly banks. There will be fewer to act as rescuers this time around, and sovereign wealth funds are also big investors in private equity. Greece moved a step closer to early elections after Prime Minister Antonis Samaras failed to gather enough votes for his nominee in a parliamentary vote for a new head of state. Samaras got 160 of the 300 votes, but needs a two-thirds majority. There will be another vote December 23rd. If that fails, a third vote December 29th with a 180-vote threshold. And if that fails, the Greek parliament will be dissolved and early elections will be called. Today, stocks were up. Dow Industrials gaining 288 points at 17,356, the S&P up 40 at 2012. We invite you to follow along at moneyradio.com, live streaming and archived audio. There's even an app that you can put on your smartphone, and then you can take us with you wherever you take your smartphone. If you would like to read along, the daily blog is eatthebankers.com. We also have audio there. Also, check out some of the author interviews if you're looking for a good book. Again, the daily blog, eatthebankers.com. Stick around. The review continues.